Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. The 70s weren't that long ago, but when you look at the diet fads from then, it's like ancient history. I'll show you what we were eating and see if you could stomach eating it today. Sweet wines aren't only just that syrupy port that you've stuffed away on a high shelf. I'll taste some varieties that pack incredible flavor. Plus, why we need to wage a culinary war against the jellyfish. Prepare to battle. First, let's see what's fresh at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with a market report. We have managed to catch up with DJ, who is the chef at Lou Wine Bar. And I know Lou's going to be on the show in a little bit later talking about wine. DJ is the guy in the kitchen at Lou, and he's the one who's at the market every week shopping. We've talked to him a couple times before. We've gotten some wonderful recipes. So, DJ, can you tell us today what you're shopping for and what you're going to be making and possibly give us a quick, simple home-cooked type recipe we can use?
Sure. I have beautiful carrots, like five different kinds of carrots from Tutti Frutti, and I also get from Tutti Frutti leeks and potatoes. And with the leeks and potatoes, during this cold weather, I like to do a leek potato soup.
Okay, recipe please.
Yeah, well, mine is very simple because I feel like soups should reflect and taste what they are. I think Pierre Gagnier said, our job as a chef is to make a carrot taste like a carrot.
Okay.
So I like to make my potato leek soup taste like potatoes and leeks, and it's really very simple. I take the leeks, the white part of the leek, and then I cut them up into little half moons and throw them in a pan with a fair amount of butter and salt, and then I let them sweat so they get really soft. And in the meantime, I take the potatoes and I peel them.
What kind of potatoes?
Yukon Golds.
Oh, okay. The creamy ones.
The creamy ones, okay. Right. And they also add a nice color element to the soup. And actually, I would say with the leeks, I do use a small part of the green just because it gives more color to the soup. Then once the leeks are sweated, I throw the potatoes in.
Peeled and diced. Okay.
And then I add water, mm-hmm. and I cover the whole mixture by about 3 inches. And then I just let it sit and simmer for about an hour. When it's done, I take everything and run it through a food blender. The starch in the potato thickens everything up, so you don't have to add any cream to it. And it makes this beautiful pureed leek and potato soup that tastes just like those elements. Now, I do add at the end, I add a squeeze a little bit of lemon, and then I season it up with salt. And when we serve it, we cure our own bacon. So you can have it as a vegetarian or vegan soup, but if for those who want bacon, we put crispy bacon bits that we've made, and then a little bit of, we have this beautiful extra virgin olive oil from the south of France, Baume de Venise, which we swirl on. So it's a lovely soup.
That's it. So just a little tiny bit maybe of salt and pepper at some point at the end?
I always season it at the end, taste it, and then squeeze a little bit of lemon in there because the lemon just acidulates it. It turns it. You can taste the soup and it says, oh, it tastes good. Then you squeeze lemon and it goes, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Everything comes into focus at that point.
Okay. You know? Oh, that sounds so good. So simple. Yeah. I love the fact you just put a couple ingredients, cover it, simmer it, forget about it.
Yeah,
puree.
I don't use chicken stock because I think then you're making chicken stock
soup. Right, then you're making chicken soup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's better. I like water. And if the ingredients are as good as they are from Tutti Frutti, mm-hmm. or all these farmers, frankly, right. you really don't have to do much to bring out all that great flavor.
You can't use leek greens like you'd use like a scallion green, like for any kind of a topping.
No,
they just don't really...
They're very fibrous.
Okay,
yeah,
so.
But I do use them for stocks. When I make stocks, I save that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like if I'm roasting pork or lamb, I'll use the greens as a bed to lay on with... Same way as like you buy fennel and you get all that, the fennel
feathery
branches.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I take all that stuff and put it on a bed. Instead of putting it on a rack to roast the meat, I put it on vegetables.
Lay it on a bed of greens.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that way you make use of all that stuff as
yes,
well.
Yes, and the flavor does come out.
Yeah.
Slowly infuses it. Yeah. So when you're doing the soup and you're cutting, how many leeks and how many potatoes to make how many servings?
Yes, I do equal parts cleaned leeks and peeled potatoes by weight.
Okay.
So for... the restaurant, of course, this is a lot, but I'll do 3 pounds of cleaned leeks, root end cut off, and the greens cut off,
right.
and 3 pounds of peeled potatoes, and 6 quarts of water.
Oh, okay.
And then I use about 1/2 cup of butter.
Oh.
Yeah, Pluger butter.
Okay, the really rich, tasty stuff.
The cheapest place to buy it is at Smart and Final.
So, no kidding. Yeah, okay.
Cheaper than my purveyor.
Chef's tip right here. Oh, that sounds so good, DJ, and your recipes are so good. We love Lou, too, and we love seeing you back there in the kitchen. And thanks so much for the recipe.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That was DJ. He is the chef at Lou Wine Bar. He's the guy behind the counter, and we love the recipes. This is a good time of year to really check into the citrus fruit that we have at the market. It's the season for blood oranges, and the way I remember the blood orange season is that they start right after Christmas and they end right around Easter. And rumor even has it that they're called blood oranges because of the crucifixion on Easter. So you can pretty much expect to see these wonderful blood oranges. These are the oranges that have the naturally occurring red pigment. They're a tartar flavor. They come in various stages of deep burgundy on the inside. On the outside, they look like a regular orange. They're a delicious addition to salads. They make a wonderful vinaigrette. You can make great juice out of them. And they decorate anything where you cut them in slices. They're bright, bright red. You can also find wonderful seedless navel oranges now. They have been getting sweeter by the week. These are the ones that are easy to peel. You can eat them easily. They section easily. And a few farmers still have some of the Valencia oranges, which are last summer's crop, which have been hanging on the tree. They're extremely sweet, and they're wonderful for juice in the morning. In fact, you can add those to your blood oranges and get a nice red orange juice. Also try the kumquats, the small kumquats that you eat whole with the skin, and the endless variety of tangerines that come through the market week after week after week. So don't overlook the citrus fruit. We're kind of in a holding pattern here until the summer fruit comes in. There's a lot to enjoy, so do enjoy and indulge yourself here at the market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
On the January 12th edition of Good Food, we talked about the etiquette of offering homeless people food. There's clearly a lot of issues surrounding homeless people, both feeding them and offering other kinds of assistance. An official who works with the homeless for the city of Santa Monica heard the show and wants to clarify a few things. I'll be right back with that on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Last month on the show, I interviewed an etiquette columnist about the proper way of giving food to homeless people directly, kind of vigilante style. The interview caught the attention of Danielle Noble. Danielle's the senior administrative analyst for homeless services in the city of Santa Monica. Danielle told us in an email that giving homeless people food in the city of Santa Monica violates a new city ordinance against this practice. So we've asked her to come to Good Food to talk more about the ordinance and about the issue of food and homelessness. What is problematic for you about leaving food for the homeless?
That's a good question, and that's really what I'm here to talk about. And the first thing that I want to say is that what you've previously said about this is really the crux of it, which is that we want to treat people with respect, and we want to treat people in the manner that we want to be treated ourselves. And so I know that a lot of what you offered the other time was coming from a good place, a well-intentioned place. But what's really problematic, and especially problematic for Santa Monica, is that leaving food for the homeless creates trash, is dangerous, and doesn't necessarily help people to get off the streets.
Why is it dangerous?
Food can spoil. And so when you leave food out, you don't know how long it's going to be before someone picks it up. The person doesn't know if it's of good quality, and it really is a public health hazard. That being said, that's just the immediate consequence of leaving food out. But what we're really concerned about is that it doesn't help people get off the streets. We really want to encourage people to be supportive of long-term solutions, things that help people get into housing. And while giving someone food is a very generous personal act, it doesn't necessarily help them move off the streets and may, in fact, help them to stay on the streets for one more day or a couple more days.
Because they don't have to go in to seek food from a social service agency.
Right. And so what the city of Santa Monica is working towards is linking meal providers or meals that are now happening in public spaces with social service providers so that those meals happen in places that are adjacent to social services so that when someone is hungry and they go in for a meal, they also have the opportunity to get hooked into case management or other supportive services that will eventually lead to housing.
And how is that working?
It's working really well. Last year, two of the largest providers moved from locations that were in public spaces in the city of Santa Monica to a large social service agency in Santa Monica. And now those meals are provided in a place that is adjacent to social services.
And how difficult was that transition for the people actually seeking the food?
It seems to be a pretty easy transition. It seems to be that the same number of people and the same people that have been getting those meals in the parks or on the City Hall lawn are now going to the social service agency and having those meals there.
Do you have yet any statistics on how many people have actually been able to move through the social service programs to get off the streets and stay off the streets?
Sure. I mean, every year there are hundreds of people who are helped off the streets in Santa Monica. In fiscal year 2006, 350 people found permanent housing. That's a significant number, and every year we want to increase that number. Once people get into permanent housing, we want to make sure that they stay in permanent housing. So we want to be supportive of services that help people once they're in housing to prevent crises or prevent them from becoming homeless again.
You alluded to a couple of major food providers. Who are they?
Hope and Hand to Hand are the two food providers that relocated from outdoor public spaces in Santa Monica to an indoor space.
So instead of handing out food, as a well-intentioned individual, what can we do?
There are many things that people can do. And I think the most important thing that, someone can do is to look towards efforts that really increase housing options, because to end someone's homelessness means that they've moved into a home. And so if people have property, if you're a property owner, if you're a landlord, I want to encourage people to rent units to formerly homeless people. If you're an individual...
That sounds really scary.
Yeah, it does sound really scary. That's not it. It's renting to a formerly homeless person who will have the support of those post-placement services. That person will come with a case manager. So if there's a crisis or there's a reason why the person is not doing well, there's a case manager there to support the person and get them back on track and be a resource for the landlord. So it's not as scary as it sounds, hopefully. Hopefully it's about giving someone a home and knowing that there are supportive services that person can access to help them maintain their stability.
Give us an idea of what the census is for homeless on an average basis every year in Santa Monica.
Well, in Santa Monica, there are about 1,500 people who are homeless on any given night. That was determined in 2007 through the loss account, which is a biannual count. That number really is a count of the number of people who are in shelter beds as well as people who are on the streets on one night in January.
In terms of being a well-intentioned person and wanting to help, the previous segment sort of spoke to an exchange between an individual and a homeless person that was casual, easy, and seemed to be somewhat effective. In lieu of doing this, and short of offering an apartment, what are some other easy solutions for people who would really like to help?
Well, I very much encourage people to get involved in their own communities. You can get involved with a local social service agency, with a house of worship. The city of Los Angeles has a program called HealthyCity.org. It basically is a searchable database of resources throughout Los Angeles. People can go online there and type in their neighborhood and see what services are available in their neighborhood. If someone really wants to donate food or they know that they're going to have perishable food that they'd like to give away, I would encourage people to contact a regional food bank. There's the Westside Food Bank or the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank and many other smaller food banks throughout the region.
Danielle, you've been fabulous. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Danielle Noble is the Senior Administrative Assistant for Homeless Services in the City of Santa Monica. I have the full text of the ordinance and links to a couple of great hunger sites online at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you anticipate having perishable food to donate, plan ahead with the Westside Food Bank at westsidefoodbankca.org. You know about kudzu, right? That woody vine that grows 12 inches a day and is taking over the South? Well, the jellyfish just might be the culinary equivalent. My next guest is ready to start an armed culinary revolution against the jellyfish. I'll sign you up to fight when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. If you've been following any science news at all, you know that jellyfish are proliferating at a bizarre and sometimes baffling rate. Eddie Lin, our Deep End Diner, is here to discuss why we should wage a culinary war against them.
Evan, have you decided at all in this crazy election year who you're going to vote for yet? You don't have to tell me, but have you decided?
Yes.
Okay, now the candidate that's going to get my vote is the one who ends this horrific proliferation of jellyfish all over the world and even in our own backyard. So that's the candidate that gets my vote. And let me just read these headlines here from the past few months to a couple years back. Girl dies in jellyfish attack in Australia. Scientists mystified by jellyfish attacks on fish farms. And the AP reports hundreds injured in mass jellyfish attack on Brazilian beach. And yeah, that was only just New Year's Eve.
I mean, they're everywhere. They're proliferating at a really, really, really scary way. Maybe they're the aliens.
They are. I've seen that the pod they came down on. And and you know what?
So we should eat them. We should just eat them into submission.
We should. Well, you know, obviously, you know, you're a chef. You know about the sustainable, you know, food and also local food. But I think we should add another thing into that equation, which is a new form of balanced diet, which means a balanced ecosystem diet.
True. That's true. And we're the jellyfish population way out of whack.
Right. And that's partially due to overfishing. We eat too much tuna and other popular fish. And tuna and these jellyfish coexist. And now with the tuna out of the picture, jellyfish are just going crazy. And then with the warming waters, which jellyfish love, and with even things like with the farm runoff, which provides more food for the jellyfish. So all these bad environmental factors actually benefit jellyfish.
Now let's talk about jellyfish in its culinary incarnation. I have a real issue with jellyfish because when I was a teenager and I used to body surf out in Santa Monica, I once body surfed over a really huge jellyfish and it got everywhere into my eyes, my nose, my mouth, my bathing suit. It was like one of those moments, a defining moment in the ocean sort of thing. And I should really love eating them.
Did it bite you?
It stung me, yeah.
Oh.
But it was less the stinging than the sensation of having this object touch me in that way. I felt violated. I felt gelatinously violated. What do they taste like, and what is the texture like for people who have never had jellyfish?
Yes, if you prepare it properly, it's less slimy because it first has to be, you know, you have the raw material, the raw jellyfish, and you have to actually kind of dehydrate it by salting it. And, you know, it's a multiple-step process. But then once that's taken care of, essentially you just blanch it really quick and you slice it up and then you marinate it. And then it's pretty much cooked.
It's just blanched, literally?
Yes, it's cooked really quickly. That's pretty much the
only
cooking.
And then it's tossed with whatever.
It's tossed with sugar and vinegar and soy and sesame oil. So, yeah, it's a very, you know, easy recipe.
Does it have a texture that's similar to squid once it's been salted?
No, it's actually very unique. It's more like, the texture is more like a vegetable. In fact, the first time I've ever had it, I thought I was eating some kind of, you know, heavily sauced radish. It's kind of crunchy. There's a little slipperiness to it, but it's not slimy in the least.
Is it bland so that it takes on whatever flavors you put on it, or does it have a very forward taste profile?
It is bland. It's kind of like pasta. Just soaks up whatever.
So it's like the perfect protein food that could be added into anything. Someone should be out there fishing up nets of jellyfish and processing them.
Sure. There's actually a man in Japan with this mission. And, you know, I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I will. I actually came up with the idea, too. Like, you know, why doesn't someone import more? And well, not even import, because we have them. We have tons of them in our own backyard. They're called cannonball jellyfish.
Cannonball, does that refer to their shape?
It refers to their shape, and they kind of have these little weird feather-like tentacles as well. But that's the most common jellyfish that are prepared in Asian restaurants in the U.S. So, yeah, that's what I thought. You know, why doesn't someone come up with new recipes? Because right now there are very few recipes. There's basically the jellyfish salad that you get in many Chinese seafood restaurants, especially during the dim sum service. And the Thai restaurant Sanamulang in North Hollywood and in Hollywood also has a couple of jellyfish items. I think that there should be, you know, much more.
Let me ask you a question. The restaurants that are using jellyfish now, do they get them in sort of a fresh state and so they have to salt them, or do they get them from a middleman purveyor who has already done that for them?
Generally, it's already salted, but it's still kind of in one piece. But you can get them also already shredded.
Do people have to wear gloves? Do you have to worry about getting stung?
Generally speaking, the edible kind are not toxic.
And the ones that are proliferating at huge rates all over the world, are they the edible kind?
They're all kinds.
All kinds.
All kinds.
Wow. It's such a weird problem. So where have you been and tasted the best jellyfish lately?
On the west side, West LA, there's a Chinese seafood place called VIP Harbor Seafood, and they have a great dim sum service, and they also offer jellyfish, and they do it in the classic traditional way.
Oh, I think I might wage my own war on jellyfish.
I think that'd be a great idea. I mean, you could start a trend.
Thank you so much, Eddie.
Always a pleasure.
Eddie Lin is the Deep End Diner. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to read more of Eddie's somewhat exotic dining experiences. Just like bread and chocolate, all rice is not the same. Specific kinds are needed to make the best risotto or pilaf. There's a whole separate class of rice that's used for sushi. And all of that is not only grown in Japan. There's a farmer in England, Arkansas, who's growing this high-quality rice. He also listens to the podcast of the show while driving his tractor. You'll meet him next and hear about how Japanese rice made it to Arkansas when Good Food returns. Arkansas has long been a center of rice production here in the United States, but now there's a very interesting young farmer who's growing a very special variety of Japanese rice. Mark Isbell, a rice farmer from Arkansas, is with us this morning to talk about koshi. Could you begin by telling us where most of the rice that we eat in the United States comes from?
Well, actually, about 45% of the rice is grown right here in Arkansas. Most of the rice is a long grain variety. And then about a fifth of the rice is right there in California, and that's a medium grain variety. The third kind of rice that's grown is short grain, and that only amounts to about 1% to 2%. And koshi rice is among that. It's a short grain.
So how long have you been growing rice there in Arkansas?
Well, actually, oh gosh, we've got one field that we have been growing rice for 48 years on. My granddad actually started that. I'm only 26, so it preceded me by some amount of time. But we've been growing the Japanese rice since 1990.
Talk to me a little bit about the biology of rice and explain to us why this particular variety has the elements that it does.
Okay. The rice that you normally find at your supermarket is white rice, which has had the husk and the bran taken off of it. So the only difference between brown rice and white rice is one more step where the bran is removed. But the short grain in particular, the makeup of the starches in it, it has to do with the amylose level, which I honestly have had explained to me by scientists, but I don't entirely understand myself. But I do know that the lower the amylose, the higher the stickiness and the starchiness and the glutinous texture. Koshi has somewhere in the range of 12 to 13% amylose.
Is it a rice that has, like, for example, now that jasmine rice is in many places in the market, many of us have become used to the idea that a rice has an aroma.
Right.
What is the aroma of koshi?
I would say it has a very subtle, sweet aroma, and it's maybe with a slight note of a nuttiness to it. It's not going to be as strong or overwhelming as some of your more aromatics like the jasmine rice.
Now, you have a rice tasting technique that you learned from Japanese tourists who have come to your farm. Could you tell us about it?
Well, yes. Growing up, as tourists would come to the farm and taste the rice, I would notice they always would pause and take their time as they tasted the Ross, and they would notice these subtleties. And so I thought I would try it for myself. What I learned is if I took a bite of the Ross and then kind of held it on my tongue as I breathed in through my nose, I could notice the aromas more easily. And then if I would just kind of break apart the Ross and get it, you know, single grain in between my front teeth and bite into it, you could notice the springiness of the texture a little more instead of just chewing it through. So if it's a springy texture that kind of bounces back at you, it's a higher quality than if it just kind of goes mushy.
Now, you're talking about doing all of this with a kernel of raw rice.
No, actually, this would be cooked rice.
Oh,
this
really?
After it comes out of the steamer, your raw rice was going to be very, very hard, as you're well aware. If you bit into it, that could be a problem.
I'm one of those people who likes to eat raw pasta, so I just naturally assumed that you were talking about the raw kernel. Explain a little bit about how rice is grown.
Okay, well, I'll start off with planting. We do that in the end of March or April, and we will actually water seed the Ross, which is a technique that was pioneered there in California, I believe, where we'll pre-sprout the seed and then have an airplane apply it directly into the water, and then that pre-sprouted seed will come up through the water, and we manage that throughout the year by applying nitrogen and taking care of the Ross and monitoring the water level. After the Ross develops, a head comes out of the top of it, and the grain begins to fill and it begins to mature. At that point, we drain the water off and wait for the ground to firm up enough so that we can take our machinery into the field and harvest it. At that point, the Ross is harvested into the combine and augured from that into a grain buggy, which carries it to the edge of the field, loads it into an 18-wheeler, which carries it to our grain bins, or you know, what may more commonly be thought of as a silo.
So what do you like to do with koshi besides make the rice for a sushi preparation?
Right. Well, you know, it's traditionally thought of as a sushi rice, or in Japan it's often just steamed and used as a, you know, as a premium quality rice to eat as a main course even. But we've learned that it's a great addition to anything. You know, usually rice is kind of the spaghetti noodle of the grain world. You know, it's just used to fill a space and it's used to soak up other flavors. But the good thing about koshi is it has a flavor of its own, and it adds a degree of sophistication to any dish. So, you know, you can use that with different stir fries. You can use it in rice puddings. But just an old Southern recipe favorite of mine is to take it after it's been cooked, put a little milk, sugar, butter, and a pinch of salt in there, and make a breakfast cereal with it. And the texture is so smooth, and it's a wonderful, wonderful beginning to the day.
I have to say that the sample that you sent me, the rice kernels themselves, they're very, very beautiful. Part of me just wanted to have them in a bowl on the counter. They're just so pretty.
Yes, they are. They are.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Isbell runs Isbell Farms in England, Arkansas, and he grows koshi rice. To learn more about the rice and get a link to purchase some, go to our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Do you ever drink sweet wines? Sometimes they're known as dessert wines. But we'll sample some sweet wines next that deserve their own classification. They are really exceptional, out of this world. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Business always has a lot of stories about people who start up in one business and end up coming to feed their soul in food. Lou on Vine is no different. Lou Amder, who's the owner of Lou here in Hollywood, was a software information architect. He left to open this really wonderful wine bar. So he's here with us this morning to share his extraordinary knowledge and love for sweet wines.
When I read a statement in one of Jancis Robinson's books years ago, she claimed that some of the greatest white wines in the world just happened to be sweet. And I was prejudiced. I thought I didn't like sweet wine because I associated it with Mogan David or Manischewitz or even Blue Nun. And I think a lot of people maybe think that sweet wine is sort of childish or infantile.
And does sweet wine only belong in the dessert course?
No, I think sweet wine is wonderful as an aperitif.
So you have four bottles in front of me. How did you choose them?
They show the spectrum of flavors and textures you can expect from a really good sweet wine. They're all really well balanced, and that's the number one thing to look for in a really good sweet wine, is you want wines that are playful, that are kinetic, that have both sweetness and acidity. So you have this rush of intense fruit, but then also the refreshing acidity. If a wine doesn't have the acidity, it's not that fun to drink.
Okay, let's start. Show me the first.
All right. The first wine on our flight is a Malaga, and it's made by Jorge Ordóñez, great Spanish wine importer, and the Austrian winemaker who unfortunately passed away in December, Alois Krocher. It is a 100% Muscat, old vines, organically grown on really poor soil. And that's one thing that all these wines have in common, is they're grown on fairly infertile soil and very well-drained soil.
And why is that? Why do they seem to do better in unfertile soil?
When you make a vine struggle, and this goes for any wine, the resulting grapes, the resulting fruit, has more character. And in addition to being sweet, it's also fairly low in alcohol.
Mm. Wow, that is so delicious.
And the texture, isn't that just so delicate?
When you drink these wines, you're not only tasting sweetness. There are moments when you'll get little hints of more bitter flavors.
You taste it in here. It tastes a little, on the finish, a little chamomile-y almost, a little faint bitterness, which is really kind of sexy and attractive.
It's nice. And what would we eat with this?
All these wines are natural pairings with most kinds of blue cheese. In addition, I find really super-aged cheddars are great with some of these wines. One of the comments one of my Austrian regulars said is that in Austria, they often like to drink these wines with salamis and sausages. And that's actually wonderful.
Now, what about the level of alcohol in these wines? Do they tend to have more alcohol than?
None of these are fortified, so they are a moderate alcohol.
What do you mean when you say fortified?
This is 12%, which is fairly low. A lot of sweet wines, ports in particular, are fortified when they're made, and they bring the alcohol up to about 18%.
And how do they do that?
When the wine is fermenting, they add brandy or neutral spirits to it.
So these are fortified or not?
None of these are fortified.
None
these are
of
all
these are fortified.
Natural sweet wines. This third wine is from a tiny AOC called Court de Chaume. It is in France's Loire Valley, and it's not far from the city of Tours. It is 100% Chenin Blanc.
Wow. That is intense.
This is a profound wine. Tiny production. What's lovely about this wine is that it's intense now, but this can age 100 years? I don't know. This can age forever. So right now it's young and it's you're getting...
Now, what is it in the structure of the wine that allows it to age for so long?
Well, first of all, the flavor is like, you take the tiniest little sip and it just it's explosive in your mouth.
Yeah, explodes.
It is explosive. If I was a rich man and stocking my cellar, I would put some of this away and let's see what's going to be like in 20 years. This is Château de la Sironde. This, to me, was one of my favorite wines of 07. I thought this was just an extraordinary wine. And I think when you're tasting wines like this, it's good to know how to taste them. They are very concentrated. You don't want a big old swig. A little taste.
It's like a treat.
Well, you know, these are also great for macerating fruits in, if you're making it like a fruit crisp
wow.
or something.
What are the price points of these wines?
The Malaga, retail, $25, $30. It's not a very expensive wine. It is a $375, so it's a small bottle.
Small bottle. Mm-hmm. It's funny. They all look like they're in olive oil bottles.
You're right, these tall bottles.
Yeah.
These are all tiny production wines. The Court de Chaume, I'm going to guess, 120 retail, that range.
Wow.
And then this final wine, which we're about to taste now, is Sagrantino Pasito from Scacciadiavoli. I'm going to guess this retails for maybe $35.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about the Sagrantino.
Well, you know, traditional Sagrantino was a sacramental wine, and it was tightly controlled by the Catholic
wow.
Church. This is the traditional style, Evan.
It's fabulous.
Now,
that is just, if you want to make an impression, to bring this to a small, intimate gathering of people you really like.
Yeah, this is a wine that is love wine. You give, you know, like new girlfriend wine or new boyfriend wine. And what I love about this kind of wine is the level of craft that goes into making it. You're tasting winemaking at a very high level of elaboration. And I appreciate how difficult it is to grow these grapes. They do an intense selection where they go through the vineyard three or four times, just picking the most ripe grapes from the bunches. And then, of course, these grapes are all affected by botrytis, so they're all kind of fungusy and gross looking. But then you press the wine and you get this wonderful elixir that This makes me happy to be alive, drinking a wine like this.
Lou, this has been such a treat. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
You can find Lou Amder's wine bar, simply called Lou, very near the corner of Melrose and Rossmore, inside a mini mall and next to a laundromat. I highly recommend a visit. Lou not only serves incredible wines, but also really delicious food. I'll have the address and phone number on our site, plus a list of the wines that Lou mentioned. So go to kcrw.com/goodfood to check it out. Maybe your favorite drink is one that comes with froth on the top and is the kind of beer with no alcohol in it. Root beer was once a complex drink with many different home recipes. There's a place you can still find a unique brew of root beer in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Have you ever had homemade root beer? I have, and it's phenomenal. Eric Seaman and Diane Avila are co-owners of Route 66 Malt Shop up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where they make their own root beer using, of course, a secret recipe. Their root beer's been named one of the top 10 best in America by San Francisco critic Luke Cole, and it earned high marks for its complexity, bite, and smoothness. Eric's with us today to talk about their root beer. How did you guys start making your own root beer in the first place?
Well, actually, it was just a fluke, really. We were putting a malt shop together and had Coca-Cola come in and hook up like an antique soda fountain dispenser set up. And we said, okay, we want your Coke and your other things, and we want a root beer. And they said, well, we don't have root beer to hook up to our own system. So we started looking around, and Diane went out and bought probably a dozen different brands of root beer, and we didn't really like any of them because they didn't live up to the what we call the benchmark standard of American root beer, and that's the old 50s A&W root beer. Coincidentally, around that time, an old friend of mine that I used to play in a band with came by with some homemade root beer that he had made. So he just turned us on how to do it, and that's how we got started in the root beer business.
So when you think about that old-fashioned flavor profile, what are you looking for?
God, it's hard to say, but, you know, first of all, some body.
You want that really creamy kind of mouthfeel along with the carbonation.
Yeah, and it's got to have different aftertastes. You know, once you like sip it and exhale through your nose, you got other flavors coming in there. And ours is, I think, even better than the old A&W used to be.
It has sort of like a little herbal thing going on.
Yeah, it's got herb flavors, almost a mini flavor. Just, I mean, so subtle that it's barely there, but and it's got to be there, or to me, it isn't the right flavor. You know the old little root beer barrel candies?
Yep.
Those are almost the perfect root beer flavor. And that's kind of what ours tastes like. I mean,
are the bubbles made by fermentation or carbonation?
By pressurized CO2. And that's a trick, you know, a modern trick that we have over the people that used to make it at home in their basement. And the bottles would explode and stuff because they were trying to get the carbonation from yeast. And, man, that's hard.
What are some of the ingredients that go into root beer? Is it still made with sassafras root?
Yeah, it is, except for, I don't know what the status of it is anymore, but for a while there was, like, this scare that, like, I think everything else they did was, well, this causes cancer, so you can't use it. So they started to put another process on the sassafras to make it non-carcinogenic, although I never thought it was anyhow because it's been used medicinally for probably thousands of years all around the world.
How important is the water to the whole process?
Oh, it's real key. It's like anything you make with water. We have highly filtered water in our restaurant, even just for the drinking water. And it takes out all the chlorine and fluorine and all the other garbage that's in water these days and makes it really clean.
Do you need any special equipment to make root beer?
No, no. Once you get the extracts, like I say, it's pretty easy. Just basically dilute it with water and add sugar in the right amounts and then let it set for a while so all the flavors kind of blend together and then carbonate it.
What's your favorite food to serve with root beer? What do you think pairs most beautifully with root beer?
There's nothing more all-American than having a great burger with a root beer. We've been voted the best green chili cheeseburger in Albuquerque, and since Albuquerque is the home of the green chili cheeseburger, we have been told and are starting to believe it that we probably have the best green chili cheeseburger on the planet.
Okay, now you've made me really hungry. How do you serve your root beer?
In an iced mug, of course.
Oh, 16-ounce
mug, iced with no ice in it, so it doesn't dilute it, which is a crime.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Well, I enjoyed it myself, and I wish I could pour you a frosty mug.
The next time I'm in Albuquerque, I'll come by. That was Eric Seaman of Route 66 Malt Shop in Albuquerque, New Mexico, talking about his root beer. A lot has changed since the 70s. For one thing, we as Americans have left behind extracts of food. Now we're more likely to eat the real thing, not its essence. Dieting has changed a bit, too. When Good Food returns, we'll look back in the past at the odd diet foods we ate to deal with excess pounds. Mackerel pudding, anyone? That's coming up next. You know, browsing the Amazon sale area, it can sometimes yield some very strange jewels. Like, for example, Wendy McClure's book, The Amazing Mackerel Pudding Plan, classic diet recipe cards from the 1970s. These cards have really incredibly strange and weird photos that sort of take us back to that whole 70s era when people had shag carpets. And apparently, we're eating locale mackerel pudding. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Evan.
So let's start with the title. What is mackerel pudding, and have you ever had to stuff it down?
Mackerel pudding is a dish created as part of this recipe series that Weight Watchers put out in 1974. It's actually fluffy mackerel pudding.
And ooh, that makes it so much better.
I can't imagine. I mean, fluffy and mackerel and pudding, it just in the same phrase. I don't know if those words should ever appear together. I have never personally tried it, although I have seen it made. It really is a pudding, I believe. You take some mackerel and dehydrated onion flakes and some eggs and some mustard and some seasonings, and you sort of make this horrifying custard and then bake it. And I've smelled the results, and I can say that if you wanted to make some very nice muffins for your cat, fluffy mackerel pudding would kind of be ideal.
I have to say that this is one of the strangest collections of recipe ephemera, which is what this is called, I've ever seen. How did you find these cards in order to be able to publish them as a collection?
My mother had them. She bought them sometime back in the 70s and, to the best of my knowledge, never used them. But then I found them in my parents' basement one day when we were helping them clean out the basement.
I think the thing that these cards do for me is it just sets up a whole series of questions. Like, is this really the kind of food you want to eat that's going to sustain you to cause you not to eat ice cream? Like, if you could just describe one card for me. Describe the fish balls.
Oh, the fish balls. Actually, they kind of look like little balls of cookie dough, except you know that, of course, it's not cookie dough at all.
They look like giant matzo balls to me.
Yeah.
It also seems like these recipes are trying to be multicultural, and it sort of reminds me that at this time in the Midwest, anyway, lasagna was being made with canned spaghetti sauce and cottage cheese. Tacos were topped with iceberg lettuce and a little hot sauce, if we were lucky. And mm-hmm. Chinese food was still chop suey. And it seems like a lot of these sort of ethnic choices in these cards follow that fad.
Oh, definitely. You really have to appreciate the effort they put into this. I think they tried the best they can, you know, given the fact that you just couldn't go out and, you know, find a lot of these ingredients that we sort of take for granted now at the grocery store.
Like tortillas, for example.
I have this recipe for fish tacos, and it's worth noting that tacos is in quotation marks.
There's a lot of quotation marks in this book.
Yes, there are.
Now, what makes them in quotes?
I think it's the fact that instead of a taco shell, they're on toast. And they're made with shredded cabbage. And if I could describe the taco seasonings, it's a quarter teaspoon chili powder, a quarter teaspoon onion powder, and a quarter teaspoon paprika, and a little pepper and pimento. That's Mexican.
Oh, my gosh. It's just, it's so funny. I have to say that I can't imagine that you don't love the, in quotes, chocolate pie.
That is definitely one of my favorites because it's also one of the most horrifying ones. Really, when you look at the picture, it looks like sort of an ordinary chocolate pie, maybe a little dejected, but like a homemade effort. And the recipe actually consists of white bread, toasted crumbs, and you sort of just press them into a pie pan. And then the pie itself is gelatin and skim milk and artificial sweetener, chocolate extract, vanilla extract, imitation butter flavoring, and then the chocolate is made with green and red food coloring.
So there's no chocolate in the chocolate.
None whatsoever.
Pie. And what I love actually about this recipe card, it isn't the chocolate that's in quotes. It's the pie that's in quotes.
The pie. I know.
So they make the brown color by mixing the green and the red food color?
Mm-hmm.
What about the actual low-caloriness of these dishes? I'm looking now at the crown roast of Frankfurters. Could you describe the picture since we're visually impaired here?
It's a simulated crown roast made with hot dogs that have been cooked and then assembled together on end, like stood on end, and you sort of make a barrel out of them.
So that they're simulating the bones.
The bones of the crown roast.
Right.
And I think you sort of split the bottom so that they can stand up by themselves. And then you sort of stick the whole contraption together with toothpicks. And then you put some sort of really sort of sad little coleslaw in the middle to fill it. And then I think you bake it, actually, for a little while.
That was Wendy McClure. Her book is The Amazing Mackerel Pudding Plan, Classic Diet Recipe Cards from the 1970s. We'll have a link to her websites and the gallery of these wonderful recipe cards on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. It seems like everyone eats salmon now. This coral-fleshed fish is on every restaurant menu, no matter how big or small the place is. Fish farms have cropped up everywhere to keep up with demand. But fish farming can produce its own set of problems, and consumer groups want farm-raised fish labeled in the grocery stores. There's a consumer campaign afoot to get grocery stores to label farmed salmon that's artificially colored. I'll talk next to a reporter who's following the story. That's next on Good Food. Farm-raised or wild-caught salmon. It's been a big conundrum. The more we learn about farm-raised salmon, the less appealing it seems. But how do we know if what we're eating is farm-raised or wild-caught? John Spano is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and he recently wrote an article titled Wild or Farmed? Salmon Eaters Demand to Know. Hi, John.
Hi.
Remind us a little bit about the problems with farm-raised salmon, either environmental or dietary or both.
Well, they're both. The health concerns mainly relate to the contents of the fish meal that's fed to salmon raised in farms and some lingering concerns about the contents of that meal, which include both the familiar red dye as well as trace elements of dioxins and PCBs, which are found in concentrations so small that no one considers them a hazard. But nonetheless, there are health concerns with that. And the environmental concerns relate primarily to the whole fish farming industry, which is a fascinating topic.
And which is mostly related to the pollution of wastes.
That's absolutely correct. The fish are farmed, at least in the Pacific Northwest, in free-floating nets anchored to the bottom or to the sides, to the shore, and the waste is very much concentrated there. Now, others are concerned that the concentration of fish also means a concentration of feed with whatever may accompany the feed.
So if there's trace elements of a little bit of heavy metals that are found or these strange hormones, then a large concentration of them could actually lead to an amount that is not insignificant.
Precisely.
So if we decide that we really would rather stick with the devil we know, wild-caught salmon, rather than the devil that we may not know completely, farm-caught salmon, what right now are our chances of finding the fish properly labeled where we go to buy it?
That's a great question. And that is exactly the question that started the kind of David versus Goliath lawsuit that is the occasion for my presence here. The problem is you don't know. It appears clear that many of the chains, the supermarket chains, the food purveyors say that they're following the rules. And this is, again, a disclosure rule. The red coloration itself is not harmful, at least so far as anyone knows.
But it's just disclosing so that the consumer could have a choice.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned David and Goliath. Tell me who represents each part.
Well, the Goliath is most of the major food chains in California.
So we're talking about Costco.
You're talking about Costco, Kroger, Safeway,
Whole Foods.
Bristol Farms. Whole Foods were certainly a defendant at one point in this case. There's no doubt about it. But all the big ones, just about everybody, and the David is present in the form of a very attractive young lady named Jennifer Canner, who's 32, and she's an activist of sorts, lives in Venice. And the interesting thing about her, when I interviewed her, was that she was raised in Canada, and she only moved to Southern California 5 years ago. And the way she tells it, she was brought up on salmon. She fished it from the bank. She went out in the ocean and caught it. She went on trips to Alaska. I mean, she ate it all the time. So she comes down here, she goes to a market, and she buys something. And she takes it home and she thinks maybe it's off. It looked funky is the way she put it. And it had kind of a diaphanous sheen to it. When she discovered that it was farm-raised salmon, she was absolutely bowled over because she never even heard of such a thing. She didn't even know what it was.
And so she ended up filing suit against these very large supermarkets for a labeling issue.
Precisely. She and 11 other consumers. She's the first one. The allegation was, and the suit is 3 years old plus, that the named defendants failed to comply with federal, state, and local regulations and properly disclose the presence of, it's been called dye, and it's effectively a dietary pigmentation. It comes from an additive that goes into the fish feed, in the farm-raised salmon. And the objective is to make the flesh appear more pink. And most people, and I think properly and accurately, associate that pink color in salmon with the very freshest wild variety.
Of course. Who is backing the suit? Has this suit gotten the attention of some big guns who are on the side of consumers that you may not imagine?
Well, I guess it depends on what your expectations are. This certainly has attracted a lot of attention. there are some amicus briefs, which are friend of the court briefs, which have been filed by consumer groups.
What about Attorney General Jerry Brown?
Precisely.
And L.A. City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo?
Both. And about 12 other county prosecutors in across the state from Northern California to Southern California. The district attorneys feel that consumers should be allowed the legal right to enforce disclosure laws such as these involving salmon.
And they must feel that this is sort of a watershed case, that if consumers lose this case, then it's really about consumers' inability to go to court and enforce regulations.
That's exactly what the lawyers say is at stake, at least the lawyers on the plaintiff's side.
Isn't it the government's job to enforce regulation?
It is. In fact, the federal government in the form of regulations has required disclosure of the substance that causes the pink color. There are identical regulations that were promulgated by the California legislature. And I'm told that there are local regulations by the city of Los Angeles that also require the same. So what you have is you have this panoply of regulations.
And no enforcement.
And there is no enforcement. Why? Because all parties involved say that there's not enough money to get to this level of priority.
So if the lower court ruling, which was actually in favor of the supermarkets, is allowed to stand, then there is this fear that it's going to destroy enforcement against unlawful and deceptive practices in the sale of food.
You've almost quoted the prosecutor in San Francisco, and that's exactly what she says, that given the state of public health and certainly the health of public institutions, these sorts of disclosure requirements will not be enforced by government. Government has other things to spend its money on, like schools and wars, I suppose. In any event, that's exactly
another
right.
Another conversation.
That's exactly. that's exactly the point, though, that these are rights that exist that cannot be enforced if the defendants are correct.
I'm so glad you wrote this article, and thank you very much for coming by today.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
John Spano is a writer for the LA Times. On Monday, the California Supreme Court decided unanimously to overturn two lower court rulings that tossed out this legal challenge. The lawsuit is now reinstated. We'll keep you up to date on what's happening in the months to come. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest videos of Good Food, including the newest video podcasts, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I love hearing from you. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by the fabulous team of Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is that talented Gary Messiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me next week for a full edition of Good Food.